It's a pleasure to be with you this evening in the beginning of this series of lessons. And I want you to look upon this first lesson this evening as an introductory lesson that lays many foundational principles for what we're going to be talking about all during the weekend. In a series like this, you always feel like you wish everyone could be in every lesson. The wonderful thing about this evening is we're also having these lessons recorded, and so they'll be available to you for future reference if you're not able to be in all of these lessons. But we're glad you're here, and because this is being conducted in a church building this evening, it is my intent to begin with a passage of Scripture from the Word of God, and I have obviously no problem or challenge with doing that. I think it's appropriate when we're in a church building to go at it in that direction. But when I do this series of lessons on a college campus or in a neutral setting in hopes that there would be a number of people present who are not believers in the Bible, I don't make it a practice to use the Bible in this series of lessons because it's a different approach. But I would like to begin here this evening with Romans chapter 1, if you want to be opening your Bibles with me. And we will use this passage as the theme passage as far as the Scripture is concerned. And I think you will see that what it teaches is that this type of an approach that we're going to be using is perfectly in accord with what is said in this passage. So Romans 1, verse 20. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. Romans, the first chapter in verse 20, says that the things about God related to creation can be seen, His invisible attributes can be seen, by the things that are made. The argument that's presented there is that you can examine things in this natural world and come to the conclusion that there must have been a maker for those things that we can observe. And so it's the old argument of the argument from design. And that is, design demands a designer. And I'm saying to you that the Scripture itself makes that kind of an argument. And so it's entirely appropriate for us to take that approach. And I repeat, if someone is not a believer that this book is the Word of God, it doesn't do you much good to start by quoting Scripture to that person. What you need to do instead is start with evidence from the natural world that indicates there is a maker. So for the rest of our time this evening, I'm not going to be making reference to this book. Instead, I turn your attention to another book, and that is the book of the natural world. The title for our introductory lesson, Where Did We Come From?, brings to mind and provokes in our thinking the origin of complex things. We certainly are complex organisms, and I think we are most interested in where we came from. That's realism. And this question has certainly challenged mankind throughout the centuries. Ever since Charles Darwin in the 1800s, this answer to this question has been provided in a way that allows people who are atheists to be what they believe to be intellectually fulfilled. The debate has raged, of course, especially in the last 150 years, and it is an extremely emotional topic, and it is still so to this very day. I'm from the state of Florida, and I don't know if you've read about our recent events, but we have been going through some rewriting of science standards for teaching in high schools and junior high schools, and it's been a rather emotional time. Lots of articles in the paper and editorials about the topic, and I'll present one of those to you in just a moment. It's a heated topic. Where did we come from? And certainly there are two major primary answers to that question. My purpose in this series of lessons is to challenge everybody's thinking. Most of you that are here tonight, I suspect, already know the answer to the question where you came from. You already are well established in what you believe about that. I hope I can challenge your thinking, no matter what your position is. And I think you will see what I mean by that as we go through this series. So, please, allow yourself to open your mind and try to think about this subject from more than one direction. That's certainly my hope. So, by way of introduction, I'm going to quote to you from a book written by Richard Dawkins called The Blind Watchmaker. One of the things I will try to do in this series is recommend some books to you. And I will have a bibliography prepared. It's already prepared. If you're interested in a copy of that, it'll be available to you. That has all of these books on it. This one, Richard Dawkins' book, was written some years ago, and I think it could well be said to be one of the foremost books on the evolutionary side of this question, The Blind Watchmaker. The watchmaker of my title is borrowed from a famous treatise by the 18th century theologian William Paley. His text, Natural Theology, or Evidences of the Existence and Attributes of the Deity, Collected from the Appearances of Nature, published in 1802, is the best-known exposition of the argument from design, always the most influential of arguments for the existence of God. It is a book I greatly admire, says Richard Dawkins. For in his own time, its author succeeded in doing what I am struggling to do now. He had a point to make, he passionately believed in it, and he spared no effort to ram it home clearly. So Richard Dawkins says, he himself has a point to make, he passionately believes in it, and he will spare no effort to ram it home. I like to read that at the beginning of this series because sometimes during this series I get a little feisty. I'm out to make no apology for ramming home what I believe these evidences present to us. Because certainly folks on the other side of this position don't spare ramming at home. Well, Dr. Dawkins says he had a proper reverence for the complexity of the living world, and he saw that it demands a very special kind of explanation. The only thing Paley got wrong, admittedly quite a big thing, was the explanation itself. He gave the traditional religious answer to the riddle. He articulated more clearly and convincingly than anybody had before. The true explanation, says Dawkins, is utterly different. And it had to wait for one of the most revolutionary thinkers of all time, Charles Darwin. Now, I'd like to expand on this just a little bit as we introduce the subject tonight, because it is here where we find the opposing viewpoints on where we came from. Paley's argument was made with passionate sincerity and informed with the best scholarship in biology of his day. But it was wrong. Gloriously and utterly wrong. You see, Paley's argument went like this. If you were walking out on the heath and you found lying there in the heath a watch, and you picked up that watch and examined it carefully, you would certainly not take the position, isn't it interesting what nature did to produce that watch? No, your conclusion would much more likely be that someone, somewhere in this vicinity, made that watch because of all of its intricate nature and its characteristics. Nobody in his right mind would think nature produced a watch. And then he goes on to make the argument that there are many things in living organisms much more complex than a watch that certainly also would lead us to think there must be a watchmaker. Here's what Dawkins had to say about that. The analogy between the telescope and the eye, between a watch and a living organism is false. All appearances to the contrary, the only watchmaker in nature is the blind forces of physics, albeit deployed in a very special way. A true watchmaker has foresight. He designs his cogs and his springs and plans their interconnections with a future purpose in his mind's eye. Natural selection, the blind, unconscious, automatic process which Darwin discovered and which we now know is the explanation for the existence and apparent purposeful form of all life, has no purpose in mind. It has no mind. It has no mind's eye. It does not plan for the future. It has no vision, no foresight, no sight at all. If it can be said to play the role of a watchmaker in nature, it is in fact the blind watchmaker. Whereupon Paley proceeds for the next 300 pages to try to convince us that the blind forces of physics have produced all living things that we observe around us without any guidance whatsoever. No plan, no design. It looks like it's designed, but in fact it is not. The blind forces of physics, acted upon in a special way, have produced all that we see. There are only two basic positions, ladies and gentlemen, with regard to where we came from, the origin of living things. And I will restrict myself in this series of lectures to that topic, the origin of living things and the diversity of living things on earth. There's obviously a much broader topic we could discuss, but that's what we're going to limit ourselves to. It's broad enough for me, and there's plenty to be said about it. But there are only two answers to that question. All answers resolve into two. The proponents of the general theory of evolution, as Richard Dawkins, of course, is, would propose that natural causes brought about life in all its forms. They arose from simple substances by natural means. And first life came from non-living things by natural means by the blind forces of nature acted upon appropriately. That's one position. The other position, we'll call intelligent design, says that life in all its forms is the result of intelligent shaping of matter, and had there not been intelligence acting upon matter, there would be no life. In other words, the intelligent design position, the creation view, takes the position that matter by itself would never produce living things. They had to be acted upon by an intelligence in order to produce them. Much like the painting on the Sistine Chapel, while it is made up of matter, chemicals that you could describe very carefully, those chemicals of themselves had to be acted upon by an intelligence to produce that marvelous painting on the Sistine Chapel. And therein lies the difference between these two views. Either there was intelligent design involved, or there was not. I don't believe there are any other answers to that question. I think it resolves to those two. The intelligent design position, which has come to be called the ID position, and look, there's a group now identified with the intelligent design movement. It's kind of the way we do things. I don't associate myself with any movement. I just try to look at the evidence and examine it as rationally as I know how. Intelligent design is a theory that we may properly conclude something is designed by an intelligent source. And the approach I'm going to take with you in this series is, I believe you can examine the evidence of the natural world and come up with a conclusion that some things in the natural world had to be designed to get in the state they're in. And I believe you can properly conclude that by examining simply the natural world. Was this thing that I'm looking at designed or was it not? Who designed this is really a separate question from whether it was designed or not. And I'm not so sure how much science can tell us about who designed it, but science can certainly point us to the necessity for a designer. And that's going to be the foundation of the argument. Both of these inferences, and please understand me well, we're laying foundational principles here. Both of these inferences, whether you take the position that nature caused it or that there was an intelligent designer that caused it, they both are ultimately positions of faith. And don't let anybody get you into the position where one is faith and the other science. Both positions are positions of faith, folks. And here's why. Because in the first place, origins are not amenable to normal, repeatable experimentation or direct observation. It was in the remote past. Nobody thinks it happened yesterday. And it happened in a unique set of circumstances. And there's nobody that can go back and say with certainty, here is the exact set of circumstances by which it happened. So it is not amenable to normal scientific methods. Not ultimately. Can you use science to investigate it? I absolutely believe you can, and I'm going to show you why I think that. But ultimately, it's a position of faith, no matter what your position is. Second, we must use present circumstances to draw inferences about the remote past, if we're going to use science. Now, I'll just refer to this text again. This text claims it's a direct revelation from God who made us. That is not a scientific approach to this subject. That's a revelatory approach. If it's revealed directly, that's a whole different approach. I'm saying to you in this series, we can look at God's other book and read the evidence of His existence. But we will never absolutely prove it from science and mathematically. It will always rest on faith. You remember what the Bible says about faith? Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And by the way, verse 6 of that same chapter in Hebrews 11 says, without faith, it's impossible to please God. He that comes to God must believe that He is, and that He's a rewarder of them that diligently seek Him. So, it's a position of faith, isn't it? And so is the evolutionary view, ladies and gentlemen. It's ultimately a position you're going to believe. Hopefully, you're going to believe it based on evidence, whichever position you take. The subject of origins, even in this modern day, is a highly controversial subject. And it usually generates more heat than light. I'm going to get hot sometimes, too, during this discussion. But hopefully it'll be controlled heat. I've read some statements recently, and I'm going to quote you one here. The recent controversy over the adoption of new standards in the state of Florida is a classic illustration of how it generates more heat than light. So I'm going to give you a quote from the February 18th Tampa Tribune, 2008. That's this year. This is the 1996 Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, Dr. Harold Croteau of Florida State University, my alma mater, by the way, one of my alma maters. Dr. Croteau, in the midst of this heated controversy, made this kind of a statement. Here's a direct quote. It is disgracefully unethical for individuals who rail against the teaching of evolution as a proven fact to accept either for themselves or their families the humanitarian benefits accruing from medical scientific research underpinned by the theory. So if you're going to rail against teaching the general theory of evolution as a fact, you shouldn't accept medical help for you yourself or your family. And then he goes on to say, evolution is the backbone of biology, in particular molecular biology, and such people should be asked to forego all medical treatments, including almost all drugs, that could not have been developed if previous generations of young biology and medical students had not been taught evolutionary concepts to aid the development of medical advances. God forbid. Listen, people, let me tell you something very bluntly. Every medical advance regarding medicines and drugs could have been made without the evolutionary concept whatsoever. Those advances didn't rest on the evolutionary concept. We could get along just fine without it, thank you very much. And shame on this man. So if you dare to question, you better forego drug treatments. We need to treat this subject with honesty, not blatant statements that don't even comport to what's really true. There's need for honesty here because we all approach this subject with certain sets of presuppositions. I confess to you, and I like to say this at the very beginning, I was raised by parents who were Christians, who believed the Bible's the Word of God, and who certainly believed in God. I was raised that way from the time I was little. I recognize that because I was raised that way, I enter this subject with a background and a tendency to want to believe in God. I understand that. But if you are listening to this lesson, and you are an atheist or an agnostic, you have a background too. Be honest enough to admit that to yourself. I don't know what it is, but you have something that's in your background that led you to where you are. And you need to be honest with yourself about that and try to stand back and look at it another way. I have certainly tried to do that through the years, and I will tell you, I went through a period of time in my college days when I seriously questioned everything I'd been taught. Because I've loved science from the time I was little. And I was deeply influenced by my teachers in the scientific area who were so intelligent and rational and could present their case so well. And I can tell you I was deeply challenged about this very subject and tried to open my mind to try to see it the other way, the best I knew how. And part of the reason I've ended up doing series of lectures like this is because of the very struggles I had myself. So I say to you tonight, young people, and anybody else, don't be afraid to study science. I'll tell you personally, I really got to where I was afraid that if I studied too deeply, it might study myself right out of belief in God. And what I've learned after 50 years is you can dig as deeply as you want. And the deeper you dig, if you'll let your mind be open enough, the more evidence is you're going to see that there is, in fact, a Creator. And you don't need to be fearful of that. You dig in and learn everything there is to learn, and you'll be fine. But I can tell you, we all enter this subject with presuppositions. Let's be honest about that. And because of that, sometimes we see things differently. Look, people, we tend to see what we expect to see. You believe that? If you are a firm believer in God already, then you tend to interpret everything you see in the light of that. And a person who's absolutely not a believer in God will see everything that's wrong with believing in God and interpret it in the light of that. It's just the way it is. And it's difficult to stand back and try to see it the way the other fellow sees it. So I'm going to try to force you to do that, whatever your position is. Here's a little experiment that was done to try to test whether people see what they expect to see. This was done in a scientific laboratory, and they brought people in, and the person was sitting across the table from you, and the job you had was to tell him what card he was flashing in front of you, playing cards. So he'd just flash the card, you'd tell him what the card is. Just like that, real fast. And what they found out is, as they were flashing those cards, people just would say, Ten of Hearts, you know, Jack of Diamonds, whatever. And if they did it rapidly enough, the folks would just name the card as if there was nothing wrong. But as they were going through those cards, there were a few of them where there were problems. Do you see any problems up here? By the way, this is a class. You can answer if you want. You see anything wrong with those cards? Yeah, there's something wrong, isn't it? What's wrong with this one right here? That's the ace of what? Spades, and it's supposed to be black. The color's not real good on that screen, is it? Anyway, it's red. So there's something wrong with that. But as the person was showing the people across the table that card, they'd just say ace of spades and go right on, never even noticed that it was the wrong color. And so with the queen of hearts, the king of clubs, and the ten of diamonds, they were all... Now, not all the cards were the wrong ones, but every now and then one had come up that was the wrong one. And look, people would never even notice because they saw what they expected to see. Now, as they slowed it down, you know, they'd slow it down a little bit and let people see it just a little longer. Some people started saying, wait a minute, I want to see that again. And they would question whether there was something wrong with that card. But did you know there were quite a number of people, no matter how slowly they went, they never even noticed? Do you know we tend to be that way? The fact is, we tend to see what we expect to see. This experiment was testing that. And there have been a number of others done like that. I think that happens to us in the scientific realm as well. Look, people, when you get your worldview set, this is how the world is, there's a tendency to see everything in the light of that worldview. Whether it's really that way or not. So, that's one of the things we need to be honest about. And finally, we need to be recognizing this is an emotional topic. I taught chemistry for a number of years. I never had a single parent come into my class and get all upset with me for teaching the atomic theory. Nobody ever got upset that I taught kids that matter was made up of little bitty tiny things you can't see. And they themselves were made up of even smaller things called electrons and protons and neutrons. Folks, that theory is pretty well established, but for the most part, you can't observe it. But nobody got upset about it. But when you teach the evolutionary theory that all living things came from a common ancestry somewhere in the past, don't folks get upset about that? Why should I think so? And you know why that is? It's because it gets at the root of who we are. Are we the result of the blind forces of nature? Or did God make us? That makes a huge difference. Which is why this subject is so emotional. And so while science can deal with it, it adds another whole dimension of challenge. Because it gets at who we are and what we're here for. Which is something science really cannot answer. As to why we're here and what our purpose for existence is. But it can sure challenge it, can it not? All right. We could approach this subject philosophically. And if we did so, we would be talking about the philosophy of naturalism. That's the philosophy that nature is all there is. Or the philosophy of supernaturalism, which says there's something beyond nature that is acted upon nature. That's the philosophical way to approach it. Here's a good statement. The cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. Our obligation to survive is not just to ourselves, but also to that cosmos, ancient and vast, from which we spring. Anybody remember who said that? Carl Sagan in the Cosmos series. Did you know that was the most popular science series ever on television? And this was his opening statement. You think that's a scientific statement, ladies and gentlemen? I say to you affirmatively, that is no scientific statement. It's not science. That's philosophy. There is no way science could ever prove that the cosmos is all there is, ever was, or ever will be. That is Carl Sagan's philosophy presented in a science series. And I might suggest to you that happens quite a bit where our philosophy gets mixed in with our science. And I suggest you watch out for that. That's not science there. But it's presented as science. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, Genesis 1:1. That isn't a scientific statement either, folks. That's a statement of revelation. And so I'm not going to be referring to those kinds of statements in this series. No, we're going to be looking at the evidence of the natural world. And I believe that the evidence of the natural world can be used to judge the relative merits of these two positions, of which there are only two. You either came about by natural causes, no design needed whatsoever, or you were designed. There aren't any other alternatives. Now, which of those is most reasonable? I believe you can use science to investigate that question. And it's kind of like this. Kind of like a court case. Where here's the evidence of nature, the facts. And by the way, we need to be careful in distinguishing between facts and interpretations. Facts, folks, are things you can directly or indirectly observe by whatever means. Let me illustrate it this way. Y'all remember the O.J. Simpson trial? Give me a fact from the O.J. Simpson trial. What was a piece of evidence that was presented? The gloves. Everybody remembers the bloody gloves. Look, people, did you have to think, was there a glove? No, they're sitting there in front of your face. There was a glove, and it had blood on it. That's facts. Now, the fact is, the prosecuting attorney and the defense attorney had two different views on what that meant, didn't they? But the facts were, there was a bloody glove. There were also blood spots on the driveway. There were also two dead people. And a host of other facts. What this is like is we're going to try to look at the facts of nature as we can observe them, and then we're going to have the interpretation from an evolutionary standpoint and the interpretation from an intelligent design standpoint. I don't believe there are any other interpretations. And I'm going to ask you, in each of these lectures, you're going to have to be the judge. And you're going to have to decide which is more reasonable. And really, it's not going to be like a criminal case. You remember, of course, that O.J. Simpson was not convicted in that criminal case. Because in a criminal case, what do you have to prove? Beyond a reasonable doubt, right? Did you know there was a civil case later in which O.J. Simpson was convicted? He was convicted. In a civil case, what do you have to prove? The preponderance of the evidence favors one view over the other. And I'm saying this discussion we're having is much more like a civil case. Which is more reasonable? Which does the preponderance of the evidence favor? It's going to be a position of faith no matter where you end up. But which is more reasonable based on the evidence of the natural world? All right. So we're going to take a scientific approach, not a philosophical approach. And if you're going to take a scientific approach, here are the two positions you have to ask yourself. This thing that I'm observing, this fact, did it come about by natural causes or by intelligent causes? And that's where the rub's going to be. Dawkins would say to you, anything that looks to you like in the living world it's been designed, it hasn't been. It came about by natural causes. That's the question. And that's what I'm going to ask you to think about. Natural versus intelligent sources. I've done this lecture lots of places, including I did it on the campus of the University of Maine up at Orono. And we had in that particular series that I was able to do about 250 people there both nights in this teaching auditorium on the campus, and I think 10 of us were believers in God. Everybody else was evolutionists. It's one of the best times I ever had. I really enjoyed it because we had lots of antagonism there and we had lots of back and forth. And some of the questions and comments I'm going to show you tonight came out of that series. But here's one. If you bring intelligent design into this subject, you've just left the field of science. Did you know a lot of folks believe that? Professors teach that? You can't bring intelligent design into science because that steps out of science. Well, did you know there's a sense in which they're right? Because there's a sense in which science cannot investigate God. He's beyond the realm of nature And all science can investigate is nature. And that's what they mean by that. But look, do you then have to leave out any interpretation of scientific evidence that would point toward design? I don't think so. In fact, I would argue many fields of science require making inferences about design. Let me give you some examples of that I have pulled together here. Because lots of realms of science are doing it all the time. How about forensic science and detectives? They have to check about an event that happened in the past. The O.J. Simpson case is a clear illustration of that. Nobody saw that murder. But didn't you have to try to use the evidence to try to conclude whether there was a murder committed or not? You certainly did. It's done all the time. Patent offices and copyright offices who are trying to protect intellectual property, you know what they have to do? They have to take the evidence that's here in front of us now and determine, did this guy cheat, plagiarize, or did he make this himself? Well, you have to draw inferences about the past and about design or not design. How about insurance companies who want to keep people from ripping them off? They send their detectives out to determine if this thing really happened or didn't happen the way it's been described. They want all my money from the insurance company. That's done all the time. Data falsification in the realm of science. Did you know there's a lot of that goes on, folks? Where scientists falsify their data to make it look better than it really was? How would you go about investigating that? You better be looking for intelligent design. Based on the modern day evidence that's here now, you look at the past and say, did this fellow make this up? And how about cryptographers and actuarial firms and statistical consultants? Folks, scientists are using intelligent design all the time. Don't tell me you step out of science just because you propose intelligent design. You don't. Now let me give you some simple illustrations. Here's one from everyday life. That's a cloud. It's a picture of a cloud. You ever seen a face in a cloud? Can you see a face up here? Different people have different interpretations of this thing. I see a face up there. I see Santa Claus. There's an eye. Here's another eye. Here's a little nose. Here's his little round mouth. And this is his big white beard. Can you see Santa Claus right there? I can see him. Somebody else said they saw a bunny rabbit. You see this right here? There's his little eye and a little nose. There's his ear. Here's his little tail. There's his legs. This is a bunny rabbit. Well, if you lie around in your yard looking at clouds long enough, you're going to see something up there that probably looks like something familiar. And probably you're going to say to yourself, isn't it interesting what the water vapor and the wind currents accomplished, aren't you? I doubt that anybody's going to say, well, isn't it interesting that God just interposed himself here and made a face out of that cloud? No, that's not necessary. Our natural experiences indicate to us nature can do things like that. Did you know there are lots of design things that look designed in nature that really aren't? I mean, they came about by natural forces. That certainly is the case. If you haven't done it before, you can take a little tiny, like a little seed, and put it inside a super saturated solution of sodium chloride, and under the right conditions, you'll start growing a crystal. It does it automatically. And that crystal will have a perfect cube shape, all by itself. Nature does things like that. So we're not trying to say, ladies and gentlemen, that everything you see in nature that has order to it had to be designed by God. Nobody's saying that. But some things do. The question is which? For example, what if you saw this in the clouds? Would you say to yourself, now isn't it interesting what the wind and the water vapor joined together to do? I don't think anybody would say that. We were over at Disney World just the other day, my wife and I, and we were walking into Disney World, and we looked up in the sky, and it said, Jesus Christ saves. Right there in the sky. I'll tell you what we didn't think. Isn't it interesting what clouds did? And no, what we got our binoculars out, and we saw a little guy up there in a plane doing sky riding is what we saw. Well, you know what that is, folks? That's intelligence acting upon nature. Right? And I can tell you, you would never get elect John McCain in the skies, in the clouds, unless somebody intelligent was up there doing it. Nature by itself is not going to do that. Now, you might say, well, give it a couple of billion years. You can give it all the time you want. The clouds aren't going to come together and make that, folks. I'm sorry. That's beyond the realm of reason. Well, you say, that's a silly example. How about this one? You recognize this? Anybody ever been there? This is Stonehenge over in England. You see those rocks? See, the question is, did those come about by intelligent design or by natural causes? Is that a natural phenomenon? I can tell you there isn't anybody believes Stonehenge came about by nature. Nobody believes that. Now, we can't explain what it is. They're still over there doing experiments even to this day, trying to figure out why that was done that way. But nobody thinks those rocks got in that shape by the blind forces of physics. Nobody believes that. What about that rock? That piece right there. You know, you can find those around here, can't you? In the mountains. Dig it out. Maybe in the valleys. We have lots of these in Florida. And you can find a chunk of rock like that. You can take it into the lab and you can run experiments on it. Did that come about to be in the shape it's in by natural causes? That's the question. So you can run water over it. That's a natural thing. Let wind blow on it. Throw things at it. You can let it fall on things. Those are all natural things. You can do all the natural things you want to that chunk of rock. And they've been done, by the way. Did you know there are books written this thick on whether to determine if a piece of rock was acted on by intelligence or not? It is. There are books written about it. You want to ever have trouble? I mean, if you ever have trouble going to sleep, buy one of those books. I had an anthropologist get all upset with me one time for saying that. He said, "Those are fascinating books." I said, "Each to his own," said the man as he kissed the cow. But the fact is, there have been lots of experiments run to determine if a chunk of rock looking like that came about by natural causes or whether it required intelligence acting on it. And I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen, that with great certainty, anthropologists and archaeologists conclude that that thing was made by intelligence. It's called an arrowhead. And they study the striations on the edge of those things and the way those things were chopped. And they will tell you, nature doesn't chop things that way by itself. Now, can they be 100% certain? No. But I can tell you they can be 99.9% certain based on the evidence of the natural world. That required intelligence acting on it to get in the shape it was in. An archaeologist who finds this was Dr. Cornfield at that same conference at University of Maine. Now, an archaeologist who finds this kind of a thing is talking about human intelligence, and that's still part of nature. You see that? In other words, that Indian that made that is still part of nature. And I said to him, "Dr. Cornfield, that is begging the question. Because the whole issue is, where did that man get his intelligence in the first place? You're arguing that the intelligence came about by natural cause, and that's the very question we're asking. But you do have to admit, don't you, that intelligence was required to get that piece of rock in the shape it was in. And that's what we're asking here. And my question is, why can't we use that same kind of reasoning when we look at living things? We can. And it's not unscientific. So I said, here's another illustration. You say that's human intelligence? When I was at Harvard University in 1967-68, getting my master's degree, I was privileged to sit at the feet of one of the foremost radio astronomers in the world. Had a class under him. And in the spring of that year, that would have been 1968, he came into our class one morning and put this on the board. And he described to the class the wavelength, the frequency, the amplitude, and all the components of this radio wave, which he said, ladies and gentlemen, was received on the radio telescope with which I've been cooperating for the last several months. And we've been training that telescope on a particular point in space, and he told us exactly where it was, because of activity we've discovered in that space, unusual radio waves we've been receiving from there. And when you get such waves, you have to filter them to get rid of the noise. And out of the noise came this phenomenon that they'd received for the first time in the history of mankind. And you know what this man thought? What do you think he thought? He and his cohorts. Say it again. Yeah, they thought maybe for the first time in the history of mankind we'd received a signal from somebody out there that had intelligence. Isn't that interesting? And the reason is, he was being paid by your tax money to participate and search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Did you know for 25 years, our tax money paid scientists to search for the signs of intelligence in outer space? They did. Now, when they didn't produce anything for 25 years, they stopped paying them our tax money. But, you think that's still going on? It certainly is. The SETI organization, S-E-T-I, is still in effect. It's being funded by private donations. And they have a website I'll show you here in just a minute. But here's my point about this. Why, listen to me carefully, why would these scientists have thought that that might be from an intelligent source? Here's why. Because they thought nature by itself could not produce such a signal. That's why. Isn't that exactly what I'm talking about? That same kind of reasoning? Yeah. Well, the fact is, since 1968, they found a bunch of these. In fact, they found so many of them, they gave them a name. They're called pulsars. And now we believe they are a natural phenomenon that's done probably by pulsating stars who send out a regular radio signal as they pulse. And that just happens naturally for some reason. So no longer does anybody think these particular signals are signs of intelligent life somewhere. But we're still looking. You know, part of the reason they don't is because these signals are too regular, ladies and gentlemen. That's pretty much like that salt crystal I told you about. Did you know that when that salt crystal grows, it forms an exact cubical shape in every direction? And when nature can do things that are that regular, what we've got to answer is, how can nature do things that have all kinds of information in it, but are not that regular? That's the key. That's what evolutionists have to explain. So this particular kind of signal is no longer thought to be signals from outer space. But I can tell you, Carl Sagan, our favorite scientist, and his cohort from Russia, I.S. Shklovsky, wrote a book called Intelligent Life in the Universe in 1968. Did you recognize that year? That's the same year that event happened I just told you about. And it was a huge thing back in those days to try to find the signs of intelligent life in the universe. And what were they looking for? Signals from radio waves that might be something nature couldn't do. Interesting. So here's the website for SETI if you want to go look it up. It's still out there. And I want to quote you something from this first paragraph right here. SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, is an exploratory science that seeks evidence of life in the universe by looking for some signature of its technology. You see that? They're looking for some signature of its technology. That's exactly what I'm asking. Can't we look at some signature of intelligent design? These folks think they're good scientists. I personally think you can use science to investigate outer space. And I'll tell you what, if they found some of the things we find right here on Earth, everybody on Earth would be saying intelligence is trying to talk to us. Virtually all radio CT experiments have looked for what are called narrowband signals. These are radio emissions that are at one spot on the radio dial. Narrowband signals are the mark of a purposely built transmitter. You see that? Natural cosmic noisemakers such as pulsars, quasars, do not make radio signals that are this narrow. They believe those kind of signals would indicate a purposely built transmitter. What's that fancy word for saying? Intelligent design. And they're still looking. They can infer intelligent cause without identifying what that intelligence is. And by the way, I got back to Dr. Cornfield on that point. I said, Dr. Cornfield, if these CT folks find some radio signals from outer space that they think infers intelligent design, what kind of intelligence is it? Is it human? Is it part of nature? You don't have a clue what it is. All you've got is radio signals. But you can infer that it had to have intelligence to get it. And that's my point. Did you ever see Contact? You know who wrote that movie? That book from which the movie came? Carl Sagan. And guess what the title means? They made some contact with some intelligence out there in outer space. And so the whole book is built around these folks that are in the CT organization that are looking for signs of intelligent life. And in this book, they found it. And there's the signal they got that they were convinced was indication of intelligent design. So let me blow this up a little bit and show it to you more fully. There it is. Now, does that look intelligent to you? Let me come down here just a little bit. Does that look like intelligent design? Well, you better analyze it a little bit, see. You've got to look at it more carefully. Do you notice, first of all, that it's a bunch of ones and zeros? All right, let me give you a little help here. Look up there at the top. That's two ones, followed by zero. Then, three ones, followed by zero. Then, how many? Five, then... Can you count them? Seven. And then? Let's count it here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. And then? It gets a little hard to count them, but there's 13 there. And then watch. That's 17. That's 23, I think. Let's see. No, it's 19. Look. It's 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, 19. And if you keep going down here through all this, you notice the zeros mark a break. And the ones count up to certain numbers. And if you go all the way down here to the bottom, that's the numbers 2 all the way through 101. And it's a complete list of the first 25 what? Prime numbers. Y'all know what a prime number is? Somebody tell me. Got to get a little math in here. A prime number is a number divisible only by itself and one. That's a prime number. All right. The folks in Contact said they received a signal that had the first 25 prime numbers in a row. They concluded from that, that had to be intelligence that sent that signal. So I want to talk to you about that just a little bit. Now, I hope it's okay if I run over here, because I'm not finished. So if you need to get up and go, you can, but I'm not finished. Because I want to talk to you a little bit about this. This is a new breakthrough in relatively recent times, saying we can mathematically describe, listen to me closely, we can mathematically describe using probabilities and other forms of mathematics whether something was designed or whether it was not. That's the thesis of this book you see before you here by William Dembski, the design inference. I highly recommend it to you. Now, it's heavy math. It gets really heavy. But even if you're not into that so much, you can get the main point of this book. Here's what Dembski says. When you're looking at a given phenomenon, like this one we just showed you, there are only three possibilities. It either had to occur, that is, it was inevitable. Nature just going to do it. Or it was an accident, which means it was pure chance. It was a random happening. Or it was designed. Now, most scientists today who are evolutionists are happy to talk about the first one and the second one. They don't want anything to do with the third one. Design isn't allowed in. We can't let its foot in the door. But science is missing out on so much by not allowing design in the door. Because, folks, a lot of things are designed. That's all there is to it. And he goes about mathematically describing how you can determine which of those three it is. And here's his funnel. I'm going to describe to you a little bit now using this illustration. Here's the event. In our case, we're looking at all those ones and zeros. Okay? He says the first question you want to ask is it contingent? In other words, was it inevitable or was it not? If your answer to that is no, that it was not contingent, then it was a necessity. It had to have happened and we're finished. If it didn't have to happen, then we go to the next question. All right, so let's ask that. To establish the contingency of this sequence, we must first establish that it's compatible with the regularities involved in its production. So let's talk about that. Is this compatible with the regularities involved in radio signals? Yes, it is. Sequences of ones and zeros correspond to beats and pauses. The one represents a beat. The zero represents a pause. So that fits perfectly with radio emissions. Therefore, this sequence of ones and zeros is compatible with the laws governing radio emissions. Okay, that's the first question you have to ask. Second question you have to ask is, the regularities permit any number of alternatives to this. In other words, it didn't have to happen that way. Would you agree with me that this series of ones and zeros didn't have to happen that way? Folks, there are an infinite number of other possibilities that could have come about. It's just bleeps and pauses. Bleeps and pauses. Would you not agree that could have happened in lots of different ways? This isn't inevitable. Thus, this sequence is not the necessary result of natural laws. It's contingent. So our answer to this first question is yes, it's contingent. In other words, it could have happened thousands of ways. It's not a natural cause that had to happen that way. All right, here's the second question you ask. Is it complex? Let's talk about that just a minute. To establish the complexity, I need to give you this example. What if that signal had just been 2, space, 3, space, 5? That's the first three prime numbers. That's all you got. Well, that's contingent because it could have happened lots of different ways. But is it complex enough? I say to you, while this signal's contingent, it is too simple. It could reasonably have been generated by random radio emissions. That might have just happened. Okay? The question is, was it complex enough? Well, let's look at the real signal that we do have. This is 1,126 bits that contains the first 25 prime numbers. I've tried today to express the probability of that. That's one. How many choices do you have for each of those positions? Either a 0 or a 1, right? So you have two choices for every position. That means there is one out of two possibilities in every position. You'd have to multiply 1/2 times itself 1,126 times. 1/2 times itself 1,126 times. Do you have any idea how big that is? Humongous! It's huge. For that to have happened by random chance, random happenings, folks, that's unfathomable. This sequence is sufficiently complex that it is unreasonable to attribute it to chance. Wouldn't you agree with that? Carl Sagan would even agree with that, folks. So the answer to this is it complex enough? Yes, it is. So we drop down. The third question that Dembski says you need to ask is this. Is it specified? See, there are some patterns that themselves are too easy, like that cube. But is this one specified? In other words, is it something you can mark out even ahead of time? Well, to establish the specificity, we must show that the pattern in the sequence is independent of the event. You listening? The pattern needs to be independent of how it got there. What is the pattern in this one? Side information enables us to construct the pattern without recourse to the event. What's the pattern in this one? It's these prime numbers. Could you generate the prime numbers without that event? Well, you could if you knew what a prime number was. Couldn't you? If I told you what a prime number is, you could make me a list of prime numbers. So you could generate that event independent of whether it came to us from outer space or not. You can specify that information independent of that event, and yet that event produced that information. The pattern of prime numbers in this radio signal can be generated by simply knowing the definition of prime numbers without any recourse to this radio signal. Therefore, it is specified, and therefore we say it had to be designed by somebody. It had to be designed. See, Dembski's argument mathematically is if you fall through this funnel and you answer all those questions yes, it absolutely was designed. Now, that's exactly what was concluded in Contact. They said it was contingent, it was complex, it was specified. In fact, they said in advance, if we get from outer space a signal with the first 25 prime numbers in it, we'll know it came from intelligence. And that's exactly what they got. So they said, we've made contact. Now, here's my question. Right here on Earth, forget outer space. Under your nose, are we making contact? I say we are. Let me show you. And I'm going to ask you, which is more reasonable, natural causes or intelligent design?